remember a time of chaos, ruined dreams, this wasted land. But most of all, I remember the road warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Mad Max Retrospective Series.
Not this again! I've been assigned!
Join Garrett.
Perfect in every way.
Matt.
You. It's your lucky day.
And the returning Mick Duffy.
Remember me?
As they review the franchise that revolutionized low-budget filmmaking.
Hey, listen, man, will you listen to me?
From the gritty 1979 Mel Gibson starring original.
I've seen the style before, Terminal Psychotic.
To the 2015 mega hit, Mad Max Fury Road.
Max. My name is Max.
All the way to George Miller's prequel, Furiosa.
This one has all their teeth.
The boys will review each film in the series, one car chase at a time, to see why and how this franchise just keeps on going.
Together they can be very powerful.
So strap yourself in, percolated media listeners.
What are you doing? Praying to who? Anyone that's listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Mad Max series begins now.
Now we bring home the booty!
All the children say we don't need another hero. We don't need to know the way home. All we want is what we are.
Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Not Mad Max story like Star Wars.
Oh.
Released May 24th, 2024. Budget was $168 million. Box office, $172.5 million. And this is once again directed by the maestro himself, Mr. George Miller. 9 years it took after Fury Road to get here. We talked last week about whether we were ever going to see this. Mick, are you surprised at the turnaround? 9 years in between Fury Road and Furiosa.
I'm surprised it took this long.
It took this long. So you thought it was going to come early.
I kind of thought, given how well-received Fury Road was, that Warner Brothers would just drive a big truck of money up to George Miller's offices and ask him to make another two of these films as soon as possible.
Okay, so but, you thought the studio he was going to get cave into studio pressure and actually get these out quicker. Oh, interesting.
Well, he was apparently keen to get to this a little faster, but again, there were some disagreements with the studio.
He sued the studio, right?
For his rights? I think, yes. So I think it's obviously had 3,000 years of longing in development as well. And I can understand, he's made that between this and Fury Road, and I love that film as well.
You love that film? Oh, boy, I barely got through that one.
And I can understand the desire to make some kind of palate cleanser, to shift into some other kind of mode before returning to the wasteland. So I can understand that, but 9 years is a crazy gap, and I think that's probably at least partly responsible for the softer-than-expected box office for this one.
Soft is putting it lightly. Mr. Goudreau, are you surprised at the quick turnaround here? I mean, I say quick. It's been 9 years, but that we were getting a prequel this early?
No, because I never thought this would be one of those franchises where it would follow the Star Wars model of doing spinoffs. Because up until Fury Road, there was really nobody you could have justified getting a spinoff. And I think Furiosa was the lone exception, but it's not like Fury Road made $1 billion. It made a considerable chunk of change, but it wasn't a Star Wars movie. It wasn't something like Oppenheimer, where it really took on a life of its own just based on word of mouth. It still was not a giant blockbuster. So I never thought we would get this, despite the fact that I heard George Miller say I was planning on shooting it almost back-to-back if I had the capacity and the resources to do so, and even with all the Oscar wins that Fury Road received, I still never thought they would get this into full gear. And also, let's remember that, yes, Fury Road was this success, as I alluded to, but let's ask this question. Did we need to know Furiosa's backstory? Which is the question, that's the golden question you always have to ask with prequels.
I want to get to that as we get into the film. I have answers for that. The thing about this movie is Fury Road, you mentioned Fury Road. And of course, we're going to compare it, this movie to that movie because this is a direct prequel to it. So I think it warrants the comparisons. But what I will say to the non-Star Wars type hit that Fury Road was, I think the thing with Fury Road is it was a surprise hit. I don't think anybody, including George Miller, expected Fury Road to come out and hit be the juggernaut that it turned out to be. I say juggernaut because it does have a very dedicated fan base, and it is vast, but not nearly as vast as, say, Marvel or Star Wars back in 2015. So I think the surprise hit aspect of it is what made them build upon it. But I'll say this. You know, I want to get to this right now. The marketing of this movie sucked because I think the marketing of this movie was a little too cocky for its own good, because everything I saw of it was, oh, you're going back to this world. We had no real inkling of what the story was, other than we saw this actress, not Charlize Theron, playing that same role, and we were back in this world. Matt, were you surprised at the marketing of this thing?
I didn't see it as arrogance. I saw it more as, hey, it's funny this movie takes place in apocalyptic Australia, but it's like that warm blanket or cool side of the pillow where it's, hey, don't you want to feel comfortable again and reimmerse yourself in what you've already had before? And I can be honest, I was anticipating this movie because I love this franchise, but I was never demanding a spinoff or a sequel for that matter. Or a prequel, whatever. I thought Mad Max, if Fury Road was the last installment and George Miller never made another movie, I think that'd be a good way to go out, and I wouldn't feel like I was missing out on more opportunities. What bothered me about the marketing, and I could see this apparently, was I did not like the casting of Anya Taylor-Joy. She's not a bad actress, certainly. I think she's actually very good. But much like Charlize Theron for a portion of her career, she hasn't done well with larger type of films. And what I mean by that are the IPs, stuff like The New Mutants or Glass, which was hyped up a lot because of the connections and Shyamalan's own universe, and they basically desecrated her character in that movie. We did discuss that, but that show will never see the light of day because it's been lost in the sands of time, like Shyamalan's characters in his movie Old. But I didn't feel she was right for this role from a physicality standpoint. And what I mean is, while Charlize Theron is not built like a bodybuilder, she's not Gina
China.
She's not Gina Carano. I bought her being able to fight someone like Tom Hardy, where he wasn't buffed up to the extent he was as Bane. And every time she fought him, she had an advantage because he was like deprived of food, water, and had blood sucked out of him, so you could get around with that. And when I look at Anya Taylor-Joy, she looks like she's 70 pounds soaking wet. And I know that I wasn't expecting her to fight, you know, the other star of this movie in a full-on, you know, fisticuffs confrontation, but I didn't feel like her physicality was right for this role, despite the, even in the trailers, she does bear a strong resemblance to Charlize Theron, especially with the shaved head and with her vocal inflections. But with how Mad Max has cared so little about continuity, I would have preferred they just brought Charlize Theron back.
You know, George Miller thought about doing that. In fact, he thought about doing, and you know, I have a lot of respect for him for taking this route, because what he was thinking of doing was putting Charlize Theron in this movie and de-aging her. And he saw a lot of the things that Matt, you and I have talked about with Adam ad nauseum, to the point of seeing this technology being done still not perfectly. And he was like, fuck that, I'm not going to do that. So he ended up recasting. And you know what? I think even if he decided to go after Theron, I think after the experience of working on Fury Road, I don't think she would have come back to this world anyway. That's kind of my opinion. That's kind of what I got from the interviews and things I have read in the 9 years since. I don't think enough money in the planet could get her to come back on and get on this big rig.
That's a fair point, but I would also say with the way this character is depicted, you know, the shaved head, she's covered in dirt for most of the movie, and the fact that she's not through the entirety, I think you could have gotten away with casting Charlize Theron, and nobody, I think, would have complained that she looks older. I know it's been a decade almost since Fury Road, but she's aged remarkably well, and you could do a lot with makeup and, you know, cover her face with that glorified gator she wears on the Taylor-Joy Williams for part of the movie. I think there were ways to get around it if she agreed to play ball and come back, which to your point, I don't think she would have done no matter how much money they gave her.
And also, I think what we see in Fury Road is the result of what she goes through in this. So as good of an actress as Charlize Theron is, and we have said many times that she's a very good actress, I don't think she could go back to that place. And we as an audience, I wouldn't be able to buy it. As we saw her, the result of it in Fury Road, I can't see her as a demure person coming from the green place years before and going through and getting through Dementis and everything else that happens in this movie. She's a completely different person in that movie. That's kind of where I come from on it.
Well, I think Miller was right not to go near that de-aging technology. It doesn't look right, it is distracting, and it costs so much that I would need less money for vehicles exploding in fun ways. And there's another thing just as well that de-aging doesn't solve, and you see this in The Irishman, Scorsese's film, most notoriously in the scene where De Niro is supposed to be giving someone a beatdown, and his face is de-aged, but his physical movements, you know, he does not have the sort of fluidity that a younger man would have. And even though Charlize Theron is by no means old, she's going to move differently, and there'll be a weird disconnect. I saw, I think maybe about 2 years ago, I saw that action film with Kate Beckinsale in it, Jolt. And Kate Beckinsale does look like they stopped the clock at like 30, yes. But when you watch that movie, you know, which asks a lot of her physically, yes. And it's not that she can't do it, but there's something about the immediate starting and stop speed of a person in motion that's very, very different in a young person than it is in somebody who's past 30, even if they're extremely fit. And there is a weird disconnect, and you see it. So I think even if they had kind of nailed the aging, I think there's a slight sort of there's a distance we have to move past. And I think that might have been distracting. And again, it's easier to buy Furiosa starting off as, well, not entirely demure, because she clearly knows how to take care of herself to some extent, but her starting off as being more slight. I've got a headcanon theory about this. I had a student many years ago who, in the middle of the semester, discovered that she was a celiac, so she can't digest gluten, but she discovered this in the middle of the semester. And literally during the midterm break, because she discovered this, during the midterm break, she had shot up like 3 inches. So that's my headcanon. My headcanon is that once Furiosa, after the events of these films, enjoys a more comfortable life in the Citadel, but really, you know, she's just eating more and better. And, you know.
I would also say, as to play devil's advocate, not just because Charlize Theron was in that movie, I will pause so the 5 of you who have actually seen that movie can laugh, is that last year she was in Fast X, and she has a pretty extensive fight scene with, what's her name, Michelle Rodriguez. And they put the camera back so you can actually see it, not like the quick cuts, you know, Bourne style. And I never felt like she had aged since, like, she made Atomic Blonde. So I still think she has the physicality for a 10-year span to pull this off, especially with what Furiosa does for most, if not all, of this movie. I would not have been bothered with her. And you're right, the de-aging thing, I'm sick of it. It's never looked great, but the one advantage she has is she's not a geriatric citizen like Robert De Niro or Harrison Ford were.
No.
So I don't think it would have been as bad as that. But you're right. I can't think of one where I looked at it and said, oh, wow, you nailed it 100%. Because it's the big thing is the eyes. They always have that that Robert Zemeckis, Polar Express type of, you know, dead eyes.
Well, I guess the one thing where they did get it sort of close is, I suppose, Logan, where you've got the younger Wolverine clone in it.
But that's true, but that's also because Hugh Jackman has just aged so well.
And Hugh Jackman has aged well, but even for that, you're saying the eyes. I don't know if you're aware of this, but they literally had to computer model what a human eye looks like when light is hitting it. They actually had to build they had to literally simulate, you know, the cornea and the retina and how light passes through it to get the eyes right. So they had to go through an extremely expensive process just to get the eyes on that one instance of this looking right, and it's why it's one of the better instances of this. But again, it's like it's easier with actors who have aged well. And also, we allow male performers to age and hand wave it away. I can't think of any sort of a female equivalent of Harrison Ford at the minute, where somebody was still getting the kind of roles they're associated with in their prime that late in a career.
Well, I didn't have any real issue with Anya Taylor-Joy's casting. She was recommended to Miller by a friend of his, Edgar Wright.
Yes.
Because Miller went to Last Night in Soho, a screening of that, and Edgar Wright recommended her for this role. Miller was like, can she handle it? And Wright said, yeah, she can. And so that's pretty much how she got cast. And you know what? From all the press clippings and things, this was not a Hardy Theron situation. It seems that her and Hemsworth got along fine. But this was another one of those times, though, where this was a very lonely experience for Anya Taylor-Joy. She has a interview in the New York Times where she says that she's never felt more alone in making a movie. And the interviewer, Kyle Buchanan, who's a very good interviewer, he asked her, he said, what exactly was it about Furiosa that proved more difficult than she expected? And Taylor-Joy gave a very ominous reply where she said, next question, sorry. She goes, just talk to me in 20 years. Now, everybody who works with Miller seems to really like him. And in fact, at one point in that interview, I was listening to a podcast with Buchanan, and he was saying that at one point Miller did come in and say hi, and they were very, very happy to see one another. It was a very fun moment. So there's no real animosity there, but I tell you, man, I got to imagine, and I think I said this last week, just going in that desert making these movies, Mick, it's got to be tough, right?
Yeah, it's got to be tough. But then, again, you got to remember this one as well, is all of the interiors and all of the studio stuff is in Sydney, in the large Disney studio facility in Sydney. So, you know, not all of it is them out in the desert.
Yeah.
So it's, some of this is in comfortable air-conditioned spaces.
I think it's fair, but also these movies are not made like most modern blockbusters where you're constantly in an air-conditioned set and everything is a backdrop and you're on wires. There is a lot more practicality in these movies than a lot of your typical blockbusters. She's also never really, while I've made light that her bigger films haven't done so well for her or have been good movies, it's not like she's making Avengers Endgame. She hasn't done something like that. She got the scraps of the X-Men.
When this movie came out about a month and a half ago, I took my fiance. Now, Jen had not seen one Mad Max movie before that viewing of Furiosa. She went in completely blind, and I'm so glad she did. I'm so glad I have that perspective, because I'm pretty sure she's the only one who's listening to this podcast who hasn't watched those movies. We went to the theater, and it was about half full. This was opening night, and they were kind of enthusiastic. Mick, how was your theatrical experience in watching Furiosa?
Well, because I have a child, and because of current circumstances this year, it's really hard for us to get a babysitter. So we had to go, my friend and I had to go see it at a matinee, like the only matinee that we could see and still be out in time to collect him from school. So we saw it at midday in the IMAX cinema in Belfast, the only IMAX screen in these parts. And, yeah, it was a respectable enough attendance considering it's the middle of the day in a very expensive, you know, premium format. But I don't know if there were more than 80 people in the audience.
Matt, what about you, sir? What was your theatrical experience?
I saw it at the drive-in, which is
the
appropriate way to go see a Mad Max movie.
Sure is.
And the one thing I will say is that behind, there was something else playing. And if you, you know, you have to adjust the radio to make sure you're on the right frequency to hear your movie. And for the first couple minutes, I accidentally had the wrong movie queued and just didn't realize it until I turned around and realized what was playing behind me. So I understood 99.5% of the audio for this movie.
What movie did you have queued up out of curiosity?
I don't even remember.
All right, so there's our theatrical experiences. I have opinions on Anya Taylor-Joy. I have opinions on everything. But this is going to be one of those reviews where we're just going to give our opinions as we get in, because this movie is pretty dense for a Mad Max film. So we open up with some banter, once again detailing the end of the world. We get an opening scene with the History Man here. What an interesting opening here. You know, we're getting reintroduced to the world. Mick, did you think this was a good way to open in this film?
Yes, but I was a little disappointed that it recycles so much of the opening from Fury Road. Our credits are in the same font, and it's maybe not exactly the same sound bites, but they're all very similar. And there's a repeat of the one piece of sort of stock footage of, you know, nuclear shockwave hitting trees. On my first viewing, I was disappointed that this was sort of recycling an approach used in Fury Road rather than giving us a whole new version of this. I don't know if you're familiar with the Spanish horror film director and actor Paul Naschy.
Sounds familiar, actually.
Yeah, he does these Wolfman movies, and there's like so many of them. But for every one of them, the Wolfman has a different origin, which I've always found hilarious. I kind of, part of me sort of wishes that this franchise had leaned in a little bit more to that. You know, if they had in fact given us some kind of introduction, which at least partly contradicted the last films.
So I laughed that it took George Miller finally gave up and said, "All right, you morons, I'm going to emphatically say this takes place in Australia to remove all the ambiguity that people kept asking about for the last over 40 years." So that made me chuckle. And I'm always a little bit perturbed at prequels that feel like they have to tell us stuff we already know. And this is a pretty blatant, you know, if you know anything about Mad Max, you know this is a radioactive wasteland. And the only thing it's adding is just the definitive stamp of Australia on it.
I did like that, too, that he pretty much cleared it up, kind of like as a, okay, are you guys happy now?
Well, I mean, the last one was mostly shot in Namibia, and there's a lot of non-Australians in it, so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did hear people question whether or not the wasteland was still supposed to be Australia, so I don't know if you're getting them where you live, but here I cannot turn on TV without seeing those Australian tourist adverts narrated by Rose Byrne.
Rose Byrne is doing Australia tourist ads?
Yeah, and I just kept thinking, yeah, how would this play with the Rose Byrne narration over it, you know? It's, you know, come down to Australia where every day's a good day. I would love to see that. You know,
I'm not going to be able to get that image out of my head now.
Rose Byrne's the only Australian actor who somehow managed to not be in any of these films.
Yeah, right.
I mean, so far as I can tell.
I like the pan in on Earth and into Furiosa picking apples from the green place. She finds a set of motorcycles and tries sabotaging them as someone with a mask jumps right in front of her, and she stabs his leg and runs off. I like this smaller version of Furiosa before we get to Anya Taylor-Joy. I think this teenage version of her does really well in this movie, actually.
Yeah, Alea Braun. Yeah, she's fantastic. Uh-huh. I mean, she is Furiosa for at least an hour of this film.
A lot longer than I was expecting.
Yeah, and she's very, very good. It's a great performance.
I was also surprised equally as much at how much she's in the movie. I thought it was just going to be restricted to this opening prologue, which granted is about 30 minutes. But when it kept going, I found myself more and more surprised at just how long she was in the movie. But it didn't feel like one of those things where I was waiting for the switch, you know, for the time jump, because I found her to have a surprisingly strong screen presence. And I'm kind of harsh when it comes to judging kid actors.
Same.
Especially in something like this, where Thunderdome got away with emphasizing a lot of kids, but I wondered how this was going to go, given that it's been almost 40 years since that, and the world is a very different place now.
For people who say, I don't like kids in movies, let me just tell you, I think this girl is tremendous, and we're going to get to one later on this year that I think is probably my favorite child performance in any movie ever. So stay tuned for that. So Furiosa blows a whistle, and there's her mom, Mary, because this is what her mom has basically taught her to do. If you're in trouble, blow this whistle. And what a gorgeous landscape we see pull into frame here. Just a remarkable set of landscapes.
Yeah, and I know it's hard for whistles to look terribly different from each other, but the whistle does seem to recall the whistle Max has in Thunderdome.
Very good call. Yeah, I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right.
I also love how this movie goes back to the Road Warrior style of all these different bikers have different masks. They almost look like they could belong to five separate gangs that are in knockoff 80s slasher movies.
Yeah. Although, you know what? You bring that up and you bring back things that look familiar. Let me just say right now, I want to get this out of the way. I have it in my notes for later, but I think I need to bring it up. George Miller does not have the same cinematographer he had on Fury Road.
No.
And I think this movie suffers for it. I think this movie does not look... It looks good. It looks very good, but it doesn't look nearly as good as Fury Road.
Yeah, I mean, Simon Duggan is very, very good, but he's not John Seale, you know, who is... Yeah. He's retired now, but John Seale, one of the best ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but John Seale has shot The Hitcher, and that's finally coming out on 4K later this summer. I'm still looking forward to that because that's a film that's never been properly transferred for home media. And I think it's the one big John Seale movie that's not been available in a new, pristine, shiny form. So I'm looking forward to that. And Duggan's good, like he's done all of those recent Baz Luhrmann movies.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's very, very good, but he's he's not one of the people who's in my top 10 list of greatest cinematographers ever. He didn't film Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. And you know what? There's so many shots from Fury Road that just, they look like they, you just take them and put them in a painting. And there's, I don't see any of that here.
It's fine. I would say it's above fine because that kind of makes it sound like a backhanded compliment. But I think the change in that, as well as one other thing that's more apparent as opposed to Fury Road, it doesn't take me out of the movie, but it does. It's the one thing that feels like a bit of a step down. Because as you mentioned, Fury Road, I could have like frames of that movie painted and put on my wall. Here, there's still some provocative shots, but they're not as epic or as colorful. Like I noticed the palette in this movie is nowhere near as a full spectrum as what Fury Road showed.
They get on horseback as she takes out a marauder and grabs his bike. Furiosa wakes up with her head right next to a motorcycle wheel as Mary starts sniping them out. Furiosa is able to chew a hole in the gas line as Mary continues to pursue them. Furiosa is brought before Dementis, played by Chris Hemsworth.
Oh, God. Is he ever played by Chris Hemsworth?
All right. So here's a role that has been praised a lot. Hemsworth has said he based a lot of his voice on a seagull. We have a fake nose being put on him. I think Hemsworth is okay. But I don't think he's as good at playing this manic villain as everyone seems to think he is.
Oh, no, I think he's magnificent.
Really?
I think the question going into this movie was, do we really need a Furiosa backstory, you know, fully mapped out and shown to us? And I think Chris Hemsworth and the character of Dementis make that question completely moot, because Dementis is the kind of villain we've not seen in this movie series before. You know, in that he's terribly flawed, and he's competent, but not competent enough. It's great. I love this. I love this whole concept that he's the wasteland warlord who doesn't quite make it. You know, that's endlessly entertaining to me and fascinating.
Wow. Matt, be the tiebreaker. How do you think Hemsworth is in this?
You know, Fury Road, everyone complained about how Furiosa stole the movie from Mad Max, you know, the people who don't actually understand this franchise. And I love how in this movie, another character steals the movie from Furiosa, because I think...
You guys are out of your
minds. Hemsworth is so freaking good in this movie, to the chagrin of Guarneri, because I know he hates that man with passion. So I had a thought when I was watching this movie. And I was thinking about Chris Hemsworth, I'm like, I think... he's better suited to play these type of villains because he did something similar in Bad Times at the El Royale, which it was kind of one of those movies that tried to ride off the success of The Hateful Eight. It's like a whodunit. He doesn't come in until the last part of the movie, but he elevates it. And I was worried he was going to recycle that performance here. And to Mick's point, I like that we finally have a villain in this franchise to where he's only scary and intimidating to a little girl. Once she grows up, you realize how this guy is good at staying in his lane, no pun intended, and he wants power. But when he finally gets it and somewhat legitimizes his place, it's not that he's incompetent, but it's that he doesn't know how to lead effectively. And he also doesn't know how to bullshit people effectively. So you could argue this is making a statement on, you know, certain political figures nowadays. I think that is emphatic. What bothered me was the nose. This is the one thing I didn't like, because it's so pronounced that it's off-putting every time you see it. I know that's the point, but you might as well have cast Adrian Brody in this role if you were going to do that. or dig up Jimmy Durante, like one of those, one of those type of things. But I think as a performance, he's great. I think he chews the scenery effectively. And I think how his performance changes throughout the movie is important, because this movie is told from Furiosa's point of view, and specifically on how she sees this guy.
Man, I don't see it. I see him chewing the scenery, but I don't see it being that effective. I'm not on the same page as you guys with that. Like, this teddy bear on his back. Like, do we actually believe that was from a daughter of his that died, or is he just bullshitting?
No, I think he's on the level. This is the thing. He is a... Okay, the interesting thing about this movie is it leans heavily into the idea that absolutely everyone in this universe would have some terrible form of PTSD or some combination of that and survivor's guilt. And, you know, all of these characters are terribly traumatized. And, you know, with Dementis, that doesn't excuse his actions. But it's a really interesting thing, you know, to have playing with this character. And we've had little hints of this, like in Road Warrior, we get that one line from Humongous when he's holding Wes at bay, saying, "We've all lost people we love." But in Road Warrior, that plays kind of like a joke, yeah? Whereas here, yeah, they seem to be on the level, you know, the idea that, yeah, everyone who survived the end of the world is going to be messed up and have terrible regrets and have lost people. You know, everyone's broken.
To further emphasize that point, you also would have people who would use that as an opportunity for leverage to gain sympathy or support, even though they're entirely full of shit.
Oh, I think he's doing exactly that. When he tells her that he's going to take her home tomorrow and all she needs to do is rest, that's a threat. That is not any sort of form of sympathy whatsoever.
But it's so funny when we see him, you know, when he's in his tent in the desert and he's got his white cape on, and the history man is explaining some technical jargon to him about an engine, like about an aircraft engine.
Yeah.
And he's nodding. And it's great because it's a... Dementis is completely about his classical pretensions, yes? Even the fact that he's having meetings in a tent and that he's wearing this robe and he's trying to present himself, certainly at this part in the movie, as if he's some kind of biblical leader or Roman general. And this is his learned person who helps him become even more intelligent and brilliant. You know, the fact that he's learning words from the history man and then mispronouncing them, it's great. He has all of these, I don't even remember, I think there was a point in George W. Bush's presidency where some journalist noted that he seemed to be doing the word of the day thing, that he seemed to have a word of the day calendar, because he kept using Krivorian a word of the day into his speech when he was doing White House press conferences. And I like the idea that Dementis is the same thing. You know, he'll try. He's got this history man, this person who's literate, who remembers more of the old world than he does, and he's going to learn things from him so he can be impressive. You know, not just a striking physical specimen and a warlord, but he'll also know things. You know, I find this hysterically funny. This whole setup.
It's also funny how everything is connected, Garrett, because we literally just saw this in Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes with Proxima.
Yeah.
Caesar, where he has William H. Macy telling him about history, and, you know, much like that, this character, Dementis, is very infatuated with Eastern European culture and Christian iconography, right down to crucifixions.
I thought of that, too.
Because that's, you know, the old way of thinking, and you could kind of look at this as, like, the Dark Ages 2.0, where Western civilization, being like the Roman Empire, finally fell, and now it has become pure tribalism.
We're seeing dogs eat a corpse. to go on Matt's point that he brought up earlier, I do like that we are reincarnating images from Road Warrior, because this helmet that Mary puts on, it evokes the exact feeling from Road Warrior. And we see a huge dust storm as Mary comes to rescue her. We see a peach get squished on camera, which is very, very symbolic. And of course, this woman, her mom spares, completely rats her out, and Mary is shot in the back, forcing her to take off her disguise.
Now, we've got one other thing here that's happening in this whole sequence that you may have missed, but I need to point it out, because I get very excited every time somebody who's been in one of the past films pops up again. Person who Mary Giovassa kills with a slingshot, the guy at the
tent. Is that Bruce Spence?
No, that is Tim Burns, who was Johnny the Boy in the first film. He's aged pretty well.
Yeah, he has.
You know, he's a certainly aged better than his more famous co-star. But, yeah, no, so it's, I didn't recognize him. I saw him in the credits. I was like, oh, okay. But yep.
He loves to bring those guys back, doesn't he?
Well, they did, you know. It's been so long.
Yeah.
You know, it's no longer distracting. They don't look like they did in 1979, you know.
We see a dog sniffing out where Mary and Furiosa are as they get to safety. Mary tells Furiosa to ride her way home as Mary stays back. She's taking out guy after guy with her sniper rifle. Some great shots here as she whips some guys with her rifle before getting captured herself as Furiosa witnesses Mary getting strung up and crucified. Ooh. Wow.
Yeah, and I like that it kind of, we push into Furiosa's eye seeing this.
Yes. Yeah, he's evoking that imagery, too. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, no, it's funny as well, because it is just, this is the one film in this franchise that I think has the most horror movie-like imagery in it. It's not constant, but you notice it when it pops up. And that whole eyeball...
You think so?
Yeah, I think that whole eyeball shot is kind of... It reminds me, maybe not of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but of one of the posters I saw for it, for one of the myriad DVD releases of it, where the poster was the eyeball and Leatherface reflected in it. It feels like that. It feels like a sort of a horror comic image.
Well, Matt brought that up when we did Road Warrior. That Road Warrior was kind of a horror film as well as a road rage movie.
I don't know if it's as much, but you could also argue the first one has a lot of horror imagery, considering what it, in a lot of ways, what it spawned. But there's definitely some stuff. But I was impressed by how well this movie, without outright saying X amount of years has passed, lets you know the passage of time, and the transitions are all really well done. Like with this eye shot, and then the cut. I think all that stuff is really well executed.
All right, you mentioned transitions. What do you guys feel about this movie being split into chapters?
I love this.
Okay.
I love the fact that they've just did that. He's just gone and put in chaptering in this, but I think chaptering is underused. I think it really works here. And of course, Miller's got form for this. You'll remember, of course, that both Babe films have chapters.
Yeah.
I have said that when this comes out in Blu-ray and I can rip this to my computer properly, I am going to re-edit all of the chapter stops in this to put in the mice from Babe. You remember the way when they have the chapter stops in the Babe films? The mice appear in a little Irish mic in the corner of the screen and say the titles. I'm going to do this here so that we'll get to, you know, there'll be little mice in the corner of the screen going, chapter two! Chapter from the wasteland! Three! I think that will improve this movie. It won't, but it will be an amusing joke. So I'll have to commit to it now.
Matt, how do you feel about this splitting into chapters?
I'm always going to be a bit apprehensive about it, because I think it's a pretentious thing to do, no matter what context, but it didn't make me squirm in my seat like it does with a lot of Tarantino movies, or Wes Anderson especially. That's the one where like, oh my God, will you fucking stop? But because of this movie's really, it's really episodic. With how it tells the story, which I think is also a good way, though, to counter the whole notion of a prequel being unnecessary by its very nature.
Yeah, I'm with Matt on this. I think it works for this particular story. I'm glad he didn't choose to do this, you know, last week or in the previous films. I think in order to tell this particular story, this particular prequel story, he kind of needs to do this because her life is a big set of chapters, you know. I mean, at the end of the movie, during the credits, we're going to see the chapter that we ended on last week. So I do like that we're seeing her life through her eyes, as Matt mentioned earlier, in chapter form. I think it works for this movie. But I'm with him as well, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, where I'm usually not. So I think Miller uses it well here. We cut to a cavalry going through the desert as we're seeing someone tied to cars and get ripped apart as Dementis spews some nonsense, and Furiosa looks on.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is one of the other funner things in this movie, I found, is that we have a... with Hemsworth giving this performance, I find very entertaining, but they've also hired Hemsworth's wife.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Elsa Pataky, who we've seen previously, has two roles in this film.
She has two roles in this?
Yes, we see... because she is one of these people who joins Dementis' gang. She plays the character Mr. Norton. And her deranged kind of a her deranged piratey energy is a delight. But she's in the film earlier. She's also the woman from the Green Place who gives Furiosa's mum the bullet. So that's what that's kind of a more representative look of what Elsa Pataky normally looks like on screen. And she's actually done an impressive thing here, apart from playing two roles in this one movie. Because you know she's in some of the Fast and Furious films as well, yes?
Yes, me and Matt covered them, and the only role she played in that was the arm candy to Vin Diesel.
Okay.
Because that was the only thing that she could do.
Well, so she's been in a Mad Max sequel, and she's been in the Fast and Furious films, yes? And obviously Charlize Theron has done both those things as well. But Elsa Pataky has also been in a Reanimator sequel. So, you know... she's the female lead in Beyond Reanimator, which they filmed in her native Spain.
You may have just opened up the floodgates to your next retrospective on this podcast, sir.
Yeah, kind of. She doesn't seem to be in an awful lot of stuff. Where she is, I'm not seeing it. So I'm always glad when she pops up in movies, even in like a little supporting role, because she just seems to be having the best time here.
Dementis tells Furiosa that she might want to close her eyes as he explains the teddy bear he has actually belongs to his own little ones as he gives it to her, but she drops it. We see Dementis eating human sausage, so we're finding out he's a cannibal.
Well, we're finding out that he's making sausage from human blood. So I don't know if this counts as cannibalism per se.
Dude, this is cannibalism. You're eating human flesh here.
Well, no, but you're eating human blood. It's blood sausage like black pudding, you know,
Oof.
So it's you don't actually have to kill and eat the person. You can just extract their blood, which is clearly what's been going on here. He needs the protein because of his arms.
Yeah.
He's still hilariously...
Yeah, I thought of that too.
So yeah, he needs the protein, you know.
I was thinking of it's kind of like the Road Warrior where he's eating dog food. Where it's you make stuff out of necessity.
So Furiosa won't talk even to somebody who offers to teach her how to write.
Yeah.
Great overhead shot of this cavalry just going through the desert. It's almost as if Dementis is riding a chariot. Like, what is this thing he's riding in this?
Oh,
it's supposed to be one of those, like, Ben-Hur-style racing chariots.
And do you know the genesis of how they put this in the film?
No.
Miller saw actual footage of one of these. I believe it was, like, a police department event. Sort of old archive footage of some kind of Sydney Police Department event, I think. But people have done this before. People have done this since the 1930s. They've built motorcycle chariots. It's a thing you can do if you if you want to be awesome, I guess.
I like the idea that he's had this idea in his head for a while. They wrote it up, obviously, right when they did Fury Road. But all of a sudden, he's just like, you know what? I saw this little chariot thing on TV in a parade and I want to put it in my movie. It's just funny how his mind works.
Yeah,
you know?
But it's also a nice piece of variation, you know.
Of course, yeah.
You know, we see lots of strange vehicles, but after a certain point, it becomes harder and harder to come up with ones that are distinct or aren't variations of something we've seen before. And yeah, no one's done this before in this franchise.
That's a good point.
Yay!
We see Dementis and his crew. They run over a lizard on a bike while entering the Citadel, where apparently all the good stuff is.
Yes. The actor, the war boy whom they find, who leads them to the Citadel, I've forgotten the performer's name, but an interesting thing Miller did this time around was a lot of the war boys are cast from maybe not even necessarily actors, but young people whom Miller had heard had either been bullied or been having a hard time. I think the performer here had has some kind of mild genetic disease. Yes, it's sort of, there's a sort of, his face is distinctive. I don't want to misspeak about this, but again, Miller, we see this later on, at least two of the other War Boys cast, including the War Pup, were all people who had been having a hard time, and Miller thought it would cheer them up if he put them in a Mad Max film.
That's supposed to put him in a better mood?
Well, yeah, it's an awesome thing to be in, you know.
But they said, what's that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Matt, this is getting the prequel trope out of the way, right? We are reintroduced to Immortan Joe.
Well, here's the what this movie does well as far as good prequelitis is when you finally see the Citadel, there's not this excessive fanfare or acting like, hey, remember this thing? It's actually integral to the story.
Yeah. I think the weird thing here is how surprisingly solid and tight the storytelling here actually is, even though this is a prequel and those, as a form, have a deservedly bad reputation, you know.
I agree with you. I think as far as prequels go, I think the storytelling here is pretty tight. This movie's over 2 hours. I think it holds together pretty well. I also love this mic that Dementis carries around with him. this Howard Stern type microphone. This is amazing. Even after all his pontificating, though, Immortan Joe isn't budging as he forces Dementis to choose one war boy. His lackey chooses one on a bridge. That is amazing. It's amazing that he can pinpoint where exactly he pointed as we see chrome sprayed and he ziplines down and explodes.
Yes, we need to talk about Dementis's lieutenant who picks the war boy, Smeg. Just, I love Smeg so much in this film. I love his crazy,
yeah,
chaotic energy
fun.
And his little. I'd say string vest, but you guys don't call vests vests. You call waistcoats vests, and it all gets confusing. Do you call that a singlet? It's what we would call a string vest, and I love the fact that he's wearing that. And just this kind of looks like he might have been a children's entertainer in another life.
Now, did we meet Scrotus last week? We didn't, did we?
No.
This is made up for, this is a new character for this film.
New character, yeah. But same actor.
But we have Scrotus, Scrotum, and Rictus, Rectum. Like, what is Miller's mind here? It's so
well,
weird.
Well, it's a... You know, if you've got a character who's like the embodiment of the patriarchy, yeah,
mm-hmm.
You might as well do the whole hog and have him give his kids ridiculous, ridiculous phallic-sounding names.
This whole, like, kamikaze thing. I like how grandiose and theatrical everything is. It feels very much in line with what we saw in Fury Road. Like this thing might as well be, like, professional wrestling with all the pyro and, you know, these weird... Like, this looks like the rock and wrestling era.
We see a fight break out. But Furiosa is taken away from the fight as we once again fade to black and we cut to Gastown.
Gastown.
Nick, you love Gastown, huh?
Oh, man. I you know, I think I said before that Miller is often a better Terry Gilliam than Terry Gilliam. And wow, does Gastown prove that point?
They motor their way toward Gastown as Dementis takes out a couple war boys. The gates are open and Dementis enters. Immortan Joe says they need to listen to what Dementis says and then kill him on the spot. They threaten to blow up Gastown and Dementis negotiates the doubling of everything before he leaves. Immortan Joe takes a liking to Furiosa as she is untouched by man and disease. So, of course, this is how we get the origin of Immortan Joe and being introduced to Furiosa.
I'm thankful they didn't do the obvious thing of having her go with Immortan Joe as the last scene of the movie.
Yeah.
The last scene of the movie has its own problems, but we'll get there. Dementis says that she's his daughter and won't part with her, and she tells Joe that Dementis is not her father and that he slaughtered her mother. Joe says that he will take the girl as well as Dementis' physician as part of the negotiations as he reaches out and takes the teddy bear from her. We see some of the women being part of what we saw last week, the mothers, if you will, and Joe imprisons Furiosa as part of the wives. And then... Matt, Furiosa starts cutting her hair. She cuts her hair because she doesn't want to be looked at as pretty, Mick. Am I getting that right? Like, why exactly is she doing this here?
I think she wants to be able to escape and disguise herself quickly. So
it's
she's
a disguise. Okay.
So she's cutting her off and putting it, using wax to attach her hair to like a little lace doily so that it's, her hair becomes a wig. So that I guess if she's thinking, yeah, if she can disguise herself as a guy and escape... but also perhaps he'll have her hair to fall back on in case that doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a weird conundrum she finds herself in, because she's cutting her hair, but she doesn't cut her hair. Like, she just keeps it as a wig, as you mentioned.
Yeah, but that's... If she's already thinking, well, if I can escape from here, perhaps, you know, it's a... Perhaps being able to code switch between genders will be a useful thing. I don't know why she wouldn't just completely shave it all, but, you know, it's a nice scene. It's weirdly mythic. You know, we constantly have these things in folk tales and myths with women cutting their hair off.
What's Balan?
Yeah, no, it feels like a fun mythical motif to actually have in here at this point. Yeah, it also gives us a reason why Rictus can't catch her, because Rictus has an unhealthy interest in her and chases her. Well, I mean, it's all leading up to that shot of the what happens to the wig and how much time that tells us has passed, which is gorgeous.
Of course. Matt, how do you feel about the cutting of the hair here? I know you don't like scenes like this.
Well, I don't. I didn't need an explanation.
As Mick mentioned, Rictus is taking a special liking to Furiosa. We also learn that Furiosa has a tattoo on her arm, which is a star chart that leads to the green place. And of course, we know that from watching Fury Road, that this is the arm that's going to be off by the end of this movie. And Mick, this goes right to what you were saying, where we're seeing the evolution of time by focusing on this hair on a branch. I do like this kind of stuff, and quite frankly, I wish Miller kind of did more of this kind of stuff. Like, this is pretty mythic here. We're seeing the branches grow and everything as this hair is sitting on this branch. Mick, this is pretty good stuff, huh?
Yeah, you know, and I always like it when filmmakers come up with some kind of device to tell us that time has passed without maybe showing us the person. It's not the same, but there's this, like, similar device in one of my favorite old movies, the Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which also, like this movie, follows one character over decades and is chaptered. And it does one like this, but it's Blimp's trophy room. You know, his wife dies. Mm-hmm. And all we know is that he goes off the world, around the world, shooting big game. So all you see of that sequence is a trophy room and things being added to it. And then when we come back, he's older still. And like this here, the hair just sitting on the branch and not being noticed as well. No one picking it off. And the tree growing inside that little rocky, I guess, crevice. Mm-hmm. You know, a thing surviving the wasteland against the odds. Which feels sort of thematically appropriate.
Yeah, and this sort of does the rare thing also that prequels oftentimes fail to do, is add really important context, meaningful context, to scenes from the previous film. Case in point, when Furiosa realizes in Fury Road when they go to the green place and it's not there, but this happened without her knowledge, I think adds to the impact of that scene when it actually happens.
Thank God this movie wasn't in 3D, because seeing this guy so high off the ground gave me hives when we got to the next scene.
Yeah, that was hard to watch in IMAX.
Yeah. Furiosa swings across and lets the guy loose as she hops across again. We then go to part 3 in the chapters, as here are the striking blue eyes that can only belong to Anya Taylor-Joy herself. All right, let's get to it. As I mentioned, Joy was recommended by Edgar Wright for this role. And as I also detailed earlier, this was not a fun shoot for her. How do we feel Joy does here? Matt, I want to go to you first, because you were the most critical of her in those ads.
Oh, she does a good job. Nothing in her performance that I thought was unfounded. What surprised me was how much she sounds like Charlize Theron. She's got the vocal inflections down to a T. I wasn't bothered by her frame as I thought it would be. Overall, she does a good job, but I was just surprised that she doesn't come in until this point in the movie. I thought it was going to be more of like a 10-90 split, not a 60-40 split of screen time between the young version and the... Apparently they use some digital trickery on the young actress to like make her age up a bit, I guess, to look more like Anya Taylor-Joy.
They did a little thing to change the configuration of her face a little bit, just some subtle tweaking. Yes. Which I guess worked, because honestly, I had a hard time pinpointing when the switch happened. You know, I didn't notice. It took me a while to notice where we switched actors.
Yeah, same here. You know, I'm exactly with Mick. I was just kind of watching the movie, and you know, this actress is wrapped up so much that I didn't realize that this wasn't Anya Taylor-Joy. Again, as I mentioned in the plot summary, once you see those eyes, you know for sure that's her. Mick, do you like her in this? Do you like Joy in this?
I do. I like that they're leaning in into her. You know, she has a stare that could, I think, bore holes in titanium. You know, and I think that's one of her most interesting, certainly physical characteristics. I think maybe the thing most people know Anya Taylor-Joy from, perhaps, is the Netflix show The Queen's Gambit.
Queen's Gambit and The Witch are the two go-tos for me.
Yes,
the menu is my big one.
Oh, The Menu, yeah. I like that one a lot.
Not just because Nicholas Hoult is her companion in that movie, and that makes it even funnier. But And she has a line in that movie towards the end where she says, "I think my eyes are bigger than my stomach." And Rachel should have said, "No shit."
Yeah. I like her a lot in this. And, yeah, it's weird. It shouldn't work, but it does. Certainly, the voice is incredible. I knew when the second trailer for this dropped, that had some of the voice in it. I knew people were wondering whether or not that was Charlize Theron. I knew people were wondering
had they brought
mm-hmm. Theron back to do some narration for this film, you know, or was she going to somehow mm-hmm. appear, you know, in it as older Furiosa? But no, it's a great piece of work, and it's a very sort of focused, sort of a intense is an overused word here, but yeah, you can sort of feel the sort of broiling anger inside her at all times.
Yeah, I think she emotes that pretty well. And the only thing I was kind of, I shouldn't say dreading, because I have been the biggest proponent of this actress since I reviewed The Witch at the previous site we were at, Matt. I love this girl to pieces, but, you know, New Mutants, even the one she did with Wright, I was not a big fan of her in that movie. I shouldn't say dreading, but I was not really looking forward to seeing what she could do with this role. I think she's fine here, too. I think she emotes well. I think the hell that she went through in her own mind has kind of helped her in this role, weirdly, and I kind of hate saying that, but I feel like the actress is letting the loneliness she felt come through in her performance, and I'm with you guys. I think she's pretty good. But the movie of this scope, and Matt, you are right, she's never been in one this big, but in movies bigger than what she's been in that established her, I think she establishes herself very well here.
I also think she's... I don't want every actress to feel like they have to do these bigger movies to feel like they've made it, because I think she's great in all the smaller projects she picks. You know, I don't feel like she needed to... Not that she didn't need to do this, but I hope it was worth it for her.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of unfortunate that, you know, the movie's not performing as well, and I don't think it's through any fault of her own. In fact, I think anyone who's saying, "Oh, this movie bombed because Max isn't in it," can go fuck themselves.
I completely with you.
Because clearly, you don't understand this franchise. B, the last movie had Mad Max in the title. He wasn't the prominent character. Nobody bitched. Well, some people bitched about that. And number three, it's just another one of those things of the incels talking about how women can't lead these big movies and make money. The bigger issue, I think the biggest reason why this movie is underperforming, which we haven't really talked about, is it's cliched. It's not a four-quadrant type of movie.
No.
Specifically, women and men, for that matter, under the age of 25, because it's a property that has staying power with fans of cinema, not necessarily your casuals. And number two, the people who are 25 now were 15 or 16 when Mad Max Fury Road came out. I'm sure they liked it, but those aren't the kind of people who I think would have been clamoring for a Furiosa movie. They went to the movies just on a night out because it looked cool, not because of what it was for this franchise. So I think there's a lot of factors that are playing into why this movie hasn't done well, but to put it on the shoulders of Anya Taylor-Joy, or play the woke card, or the Max being absent card, I think those are all have proven to be entirely incorrect.
Well, one thing to remember here as well is that apparently because this thing is now already available for purchase digitally, and for, you know, rental mm-hmm. on demand, and apparently the numbers for those are very, very healthy.
Really? Yes. So it's selling okay.
I think this isn't a movie like, say, for example, Prince of Persia. Do you remember Prince of Persia? Do you remember there was a film called Prince of Persia? And you've probably not heard those syllables in that order for about 10 years. Because no one remembers that movie. This isn't the case with this. This is a film that is going to endure. I don't think it's obviously not being the huge smash that perhaps Warners were hoping for. But yeah, people will still be watching this film and talking about it and discovering it years from now. You know, I think so, huh?
You think this is going to have that staying power?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. I think there's stuff here that's going to resonate and last. Again, it's the industry is very hung up on how much did this film earn during the first 3 days it was available to the public.
Great
point. And that's such a flawed metric, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're so dead set on the opening weekend. Despite the fact that second weekend drops have been at historic lows for almost every movie since about 2016.
Yes, nothing has done well this summer, you know, that wasn't an extremely well-known property that could open large. Like, the big hit of the summer is Inside Out 2.
That's a big hit. Bad Boys 4 is pretty big.
And, you know, one of...
Or Despicable Me.
Yes.
Despicable Me, yeah.
It's the films you can take kids to. Tend to do best right now, you know.
But I think the thing is, you look at how much money Dune Part 2 made in comparison to this.
Yeah.
Which is also, you know, you think that movie would be as, you know, certainly a good comp as far as, like, you know, staying power and brand recognition. But that movie far exceeded expectations. I think also just, this is a summer movie. But I wouldn't call this a dumb summer movie by any means.
No.
And the fact that this we're starting to get back to the era where we're putting out new movies every week. And there is starting to get to that point of people saying, if I'm not going to go opening weekend, I'll just wait for streaming. Because that tactic of waiting 2 weeks before you can rent it on digital, that's a big factor. And people are more than willing and have been conditioned to watch movies at home.
And there's one other factor that people don't mention, but surely has to be a factor here. This film's 2.5 hours long.
Yep.
That's one less screening at every multiplex.
Well, Dune was that long, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know, but Dune, certainly Dune was what? Dune was PG-13 in the US? It was a 12A.
Oh, it's R. Dune's R.
It was R?
Yeah, it's R here.
Oh my god, that's bananas. Okay, because it's
PG-13, I just checked.
Yeah, so, Dune, I was able to take my son when they did the little re-release a month before Dune 2, because he wanted to see it, and I was like, okay. But yeah, no, this has the disadvantage of being, of having a restrictive rating most places, and being longer, you know. 2.5 hours, that is one less screening a day. I don't know if you remember the production history of the Aliens. The reason we have a director's cut of that. And that's it, you know, it's the studio wanted to get in an extra screening a day and made James Cameron lose 20 minutes. This is the same thing here. I wonder if this was the same length as Fury Road, would it maybe already be north of 200 million at the box office? Because, you know, you'd have more screenings.
So we also, in addition to Furiosa, we meet Solid Snake. I mean, Preordain Jack, played by Tom Burke. Now, this role was originally intended for Yahya Abdul-Mateen. I've never heard of this Tom Burke. I think he's fine. I think him and Joy have a surprising amount of chemistry, which is going to be important later on. But I don't know, this Tom Burke, this character... This is a big part of prequelitis, right? We know that Fury Road does not have this Jack character in it, so we know he's going to die eventually. But I don't know. How do we feel about this Jack character inclusion?
I feel like he's the levity and human connection that this movie actually needs by this point. So I think he's more of an effective plot device than he is an actual character. But I don't hold that against this franchise, because you can say that about a lot of aspects of the previous movies. I was bothered by how much he looks like Max, to the point where there was a part of me where I'm like, is that supposed to be him? And they just recast it because it's, you know, a different perspective. Wouldn't have surprised me.
Yeah, the actor, I cannot unpick my feelings about Tom Burke and his performance from some of the other baggage Tom Burke brings with him. You've never heard of him, but on this side of the Atlantic, he's a bit better known because he is the lead of the terrible TV show based on J.K. Rowling's terrible grown-up detective novels. So he plays Cameron Strike in those terrible, terrible and a terrible BBC show based on those terrible books. So he has said things in defense of J.K. Rowling, who has said a lot of things that are indefensible lately. So I'm like, I'm sure he's fine here, but mentally he's dead to me, okay?
Oh, wow.
Just simply because he has said things that I support the person who wishes harm to folk I love. He's fine and he's effective, and I guess it's I think it's interesting that he's somebody who I guess has Max's skill set, but has settled into a niche, and is still sort of connected to his humanity, but I don't think he's as connected to his humanity as people say. I mean, you know, I've heard people say he's a good person in this terrible world, but
no, he's not.
I don't know. He's not a good person. He is he is enabling a system which child soldiers are used, so he's...
Exactly.
He's maybe a better person than some of the other absolute monsters here, but, like, no, he's not a good guy. He's he has some apparent connection to the war boys he's working with, and he obviously feels some sympathy and empathy towards Furiosa. But
definitely.
He's not a good guy, though.
We see Furiosa help build the war rig that she'll be driving in the film from last week. And then we see the appearance of mortifiers, and we start what is far and away the scene of the film. Now, this action scene and chase, as you can imagine, was held to film. It took almost 80 days to do so. And you know what? I love it. I love seeing it develop. I love the use of parachutes, and I love seeing the craziness of Miller's world go completely haywire. How do you guys feel about this long chase?
Kind of the hallmark of all these movies, and it's... You know, certainly up to the standard. And I like how he keeps adding new stuff with every installment. Like this one, there's the truck blender.
Oh, God. Yep. The bombing knocker.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. They just... Oh, God. Yeah. Just the fact that it's called the bombing knocker is...
It sounds like a book that me and Matt are going to be covering here in a few years from Stephen King. But well, that's Tommy Knockers.
Well, you know what a bombing knocker is, right? It's an old word for like a sort of medieval kind of, you know, a mace on the end of a chain that you swing. So it is an old word.
Okay.
And it has those spiked balls at the end of it so that when it is turned on and it spins, it's kind of... Yeah, the name makes sense.
Yeah, they call it a morning star in other parts.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
You know, I like how this scene develops. I like that Joy is underneath this rig, and she's anonymous, and she's fixing the rig as it's going, and this is the part that Joy really hated filming, because she's underneath this thing, and Miller would film like 4 or 5 seconds of her underneath this rig, and she'd be there all day doing it. But you know what? As great as this scene is, it really highlights a big issue I have with the film. I hate the use of CGI in this movie. In this desert, I can see the lines of every single CGI effect. It really distracts me. Unlike last week. Last week, I was able to go with it because those scenes are so seamless and everything fell so into place. This one, I don't know if Miller was just kind of didn't want to go through what he went through last time, but I feel like in a lot of ways, he's kind of taken a step back and letting the CGI do the talking for him in this, and I just don't like it.
He's also 10 years older. It's more noticeable, certainly, but the only part that really bothers me is when Dementis is on that rig after he shoots the rocket launcher and it collapses.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's the one part where I really saw the seams. I noticed them here just because I'm more keen to recognizing those effects, but I'm not going to call it a huge detriment because it's not... This wasn't a Crystal Skull thing.
No.
Where like, I was so taken out because it doesn't match the previous films. The enhancements are here, but yeah. Do they bother me? No. Do I notice them? Yes.
I think it's sort of thing that happens here a lot lately is maybe people who don't work in VFX or filmmaking sort of use the term CGI as a sort of metonym for a bunch of things, including the fact that everything is shot digitally now, you know, edited digitally, and I think sometimes people didn't fully understand the difference between compositing and something being completely built in CGI, or, you know, as opposed to things being, you know, composited and combined. There's not a lot of shots in this. There's maybe about 8 shots in this that I think needed another pass, but none of this is a deal-breaker for me. There's so much very tactile, you know, action happening in this movie, but really, I'm not bothered. One thing that I did notice is that these shots played less well in IMAX. Because I saw this in IMAX, and then on this last night before it left my local multiplex, I saw it in one of their regular screens, and it looked much better. I think there's lots of, I think a lot of this film is weirdly done a disservice by being in the largest possible format. I kind of have issues with IMAX and things being filmed, you know, with a view to being blown up to that, because I think sometimes the image doesn't hold up as well, or it's too overwhelming, or maybe you're too busy focusing on the scenes rather than the actual action as it's playing out in front of you. But I wasn't bothered by the effects in this at all. I think it's inevitable right now that there's going to be some in this, you know, in this kind of movie, because you're not going to be able to do everything practically. And certainly comparing this to things I have seen in the Fast and Furious franchise, you know, I can't understand how anyone would complain.
Between this and stuff like Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, where I clearly, I don't feel a semblance of reality, even in Fast and Furious. Like, once I saw in number 9 the freaking Tarzan swing with the rope, with the collapsing bridge, I'm like, I'm done. Or in the last one with Vin Diesel riding down the dam as it's exploding, I'm like, not only does it look like shit, it's so far removed from what it began. This still feels like it's the original engine of Mad Max, just with some synthetic oil versus practical one.
Well, I think the reason why the Fast and Furious CGI stands out to me is because they're trying to outline that world as something that was awesome to be in. And here, we need to feel like do not want to be in the wasteland. And by slicking it up here, it just makes everything look quote-unquote cooler. And I think this goes back to the cinematographer thing. I think if Miller had had Seal as a cinematographer, this wouldn't happen, and we wouldn't see the lines like we do here. But I do like, again, this chase is so good. Like, we're seeing this war boy just bounce off the wheel as he falls. Like, there's some good stuff here. And the use of the metal arm to take out this glider, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah, I noticed in the end credits that there's quite a large number of people credited for making dummies. So I'm assuming a lot of the people getting thrown from vehicles are sophisticated mannequins. And hats off to you. That's some great work.
Well, Tom Burke's parents made a dummy.
Oh. yeah.
Furiosa tells Jack to pull over and get out, but he throws her out himself. Jack catches up to her and says that there's nowhere to run, and wherever she thought she was going does not exist. He says that he has to start again, and he would like to start with her. And I think this scene of him walking the street, come on, this is straight from Road Warrior, right?
Well, a part of the factor here as well is this is the first time this franchise has returned to New South Wales. So we're in and around Broken Hill in New South Wales. And it's shooting around Hay, Silverton, and Broken Hill in New South Wales. That's kind of the area where they filmed Road Warrior. So it feels like that simply because this is the first time, but they have gone back to that spot. And maybe not necessarily the same part of the road, right? But again, it's a similar landscape.
I think it's a purposeful callback.
So Jack tells her to give him time, and he will teach her everything she needs to know. Which is so funny, because the next scene, she already knows everything.
Well,
so
we're kind of assuming there's been some kind of leap.
Yeah, but also, how much more does she need to know? Because clearly she's very competent, even up to this point.
Yeah. But I guess they're becoming even more competent. It won't hurt.
Jack tells her to keep her gun. She's going to need it. And walks away. We move on to the next chapter as Furiosa is having a dream about her tattoo. And then we cut to inside the rig, and now we're at the bullet farm.
Yeah.
Jack gives her a shotgun and says after they're done in a couple days, she's free to go.
This is one of the few things that props up again in the next film. The shotgun she's given, the boomstick, as he calls it. Yeah, we do see that again in Fury Road. It's one of the weapons. So the idea that it still had some meaning to her kind of is one of these little things here that gives that little bit in Fury Road a bit more resonance and meaning.
Furiosa continues to have nightmares about Dementis as she wakes up and sees Jack Wright with her. Now, this is our first real attempt at, I don't want to say romance, because I don't think it's a romance.
No.
But I do think she's kind of falling in love with him. And that's why I say I think their chemistry is pretty good.
Yeah, no, I think it's more of a sort of soulful thing.
Okay.
And the fact they see each other. It's funny because they're doing the same gesture, you know, the kind of foreheads resting against each other that we saw Furiosa do with her mother, and we saw her do with her friend Valkyrie back in the Green Place when she was a child. And it's the same gesture again. They're not kissing, they're not making out. It's the same kind of soulful sort of gesture of solidarity.
They drive back into Gastown, which has been terribly mismanaged by Dementis. Now, we saw him go here, but how come we haven't seen him take this place over? We get here, and here he is.
Yeah, but it's not an interesting part of the story. All we need to know is that Dementis has the skills to take over Gastown, but not the effective management skills to run it. And at this point in the movie as well, we're seeing another shift in Dementis' appearance because his cape changes color, right? When he goes to take the Citadel, his cape gets, like, you know, covered in sort of the red dust from the flare and becomes red. And here his cape was all dark, presumably from all of the oil and grime and the environmental nightmare that is Gastown. You know, it's a world without any environmental regulations, so we don't know if he deliberately dyed it black or it's just from being in that hellish place. But yeah, we don't need to know what happens yet. He's making the classic tyrant mistake where he has promised his people very full bellies and riches.
Yes.
And he's not been able to deliver on all of that. But his folk are at the stage where they're fed. You know, they're not as well fed as they would like to be. But also they're not scrabbling for food, so they've got the energy to resist and cause trouble.
Yeah, it's just enough to throw a snowball, not enough for an avalanche.
Yeah. So
why are people listening to this blowhard?
Because
not entirely.
They're not. I mean, this is the thing, and it's kind of he had some tactical smarts, and he got very lucky, but he is not up to the job of being this thing, right? And it's fun, you know, it's the comparison throughout's got to be with Morton Joe, right? Because they're both sort of obsessed with sort of a classical antiquity, right? I mean, Morton Joe is using ancient Roman terms for some of his, you know, lieutenants, like Praetorian and Imperator. I mean, these are terms from the Roman military, right? So they're kind of similar, but boy, Dementis just doesn't have enough ruthlessness. Yeah, it's great. I love that he's feeling out this.
Miller does a weird trick here, too, where we think that Dementis is looking at Furiosa when he asks if you're in charge here, but it's Jack who actually swings into camera. So I thought that was a really nice shot. She clutches her gun very tightly. They drive the rig inside as she once again gets a look at Dementis. Joe then sends the both of them on a mission. We see the scene where a member of the opposite sex attends to the other's wounds, and Jack gives his backstory, saying he wants to help her find the green place as she asks him to come with her. And they, as Mick, you said, they don't even kiss. They just kind of put their foreheads together.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. It's a nice kind of you know, it would be hacky if they had a romance.
Yes.
It would have been a tremendous outlier for this series.
Yeah, yeah.
Even this feels like an outlier, though, because we've never seen emotion. We've never seen a connection like this. If you go back to the first Mad Max with Max and his wife, that's about it.
I think some of the kids in Thunderdome.
Okay.
You know, where there's clearly some kind of emotional warmth and connection between them. But yeah, it's an optimistic note for this series.
Jack tells Furiosa that she's not driving the rig this time, and she protests. We then cut to a war boy at the wheel as Furiosa trails behind. Jack sees the dog and the spears. They fly by.
Wait, is this a dog? Is it a foot or a hand in the dog's mouth?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
right, because it's a... I think there's a little nod to Kurosawa's Yojimbo when you...
I have not seen that one.
Oh, okay. When the samurai at the start of it wanders into the town, and one of the first things you see is a dog with, I think, if I'm remembering this right, a human hand in its jaws.
So now we're having Miller do a gunfight. Very video game-esque, I thought this was.
No, I think it's very... It feels like something, and I mean this in a positive way, but it feels like a gunfight from like a Bud Buttiger Western, or from like the original 310 to Yuma. Even the fact that Jack's got sort of... I don't know guns, but is that an old Winchester? It doesn't feel like a modern weapon. You know, the rifle he's using, and he's kind of constantly ducking behind the rig to shoot at the people. Yes?
Yeah, it's either a Winchester or a Henry. It's some kind of repeater rifle.
Yeah, yeah. So it feels very much like a shout-out to that kind of movie. It feels like something from a 50s Western.
Matt, would you like this gunfight?
Yeah, I do. Because I'm westerns are my genre because somebody has to defend them on our website.
Hey, I like westerns. I've been watching them this summer. I'm a fan of them.
Well, you also live in the Old West. So.
That's true. That's very true. I like this shot of Furiosa with her back to a cross-like structure as fire shoots at her back. This is very telling. More stunts happen as Furiosa contemplates leaving and then drives back in. She sets up a telescope and sniper rifle as she starts taking out troops, much like her mom Mary did earlier in the film.
Yeah.
And then we get some pretty bad distracting CGI as a car is sent over the edge. Oh, that looked bad.
Yeah, so I think part of the issue there as well is that I think some of this landscape is CGI. So you've got this impossible ravine that's already a digital asset rather than a real place. So once you just have to destroy a vehicle by having it going over the ravine, you can't really push the actual vehicle over the ravine, which would be fairly cheap to do. But no, I don't mind so much. I think what we lose a little bit there in verisimilitude, we gain in just this being a big, broad action canvas.
I do like the trope Miller uses here, because, Matt, how many times have we talked about this? Where the bad guy uses his own guy to take down Furiosa. Like, remember when Mola Ram did that in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? Like, he just kind of throws his own dude at Indy when they're hanging from that bridge.
I mean, this whole section has the subtlety of Commando. Like, this is such an 80s throwback in the best type.
Yes. Bullets rain down on Jack as Bullet Town is blown to shreds. Furiosa sends a hook to pull Jack up, though, as they drive away, as does Dementis.
Yeah.
Furiosa says that they'll head east. And then we see a huge chase on land as Furiosa gets her hand stuck between the window and the truck next to her. And you know what? It's weird because, you know, Matt, in a couple weeks we're going to be talking about The Force Awakens. And when Han Solo gets on screen in that movie, you know, eventually that dude's going to bite it. And here I just kept counting down until when this hand was going to disappear and when it was going to be taken away from her. And when she gets her hand stuck here, I think it's going to happen here. But no, she still has it at this point.
Yeah, yeah, it's hanging by a couple tendons.
Yeah.
But Miller did a fake out with this as well earlier, because in the big truck chase, when she's stewing away, she gets, like, her shoulder gets injured, yes?
Yes.
I remember even at that point thinking, well, you know, Miller is all about the medical accuracy in these films, and this is the kind of thing that in a world without tetanus injections, that could turn infected. You know, she could lose her arm that way. You know, so there's at least one other point in this movie where I thought, oh, is this how she's going to lose that arm?
Dementis checks on Furiosa as the cavalry surround him, and they pull the two of them out, and Dementis goes into another one of his diatribes, and he tells Furiosa that she makes him the Dark Dementis.
Before he pulls him from the vehicle, when their car's overturned, and he's pulled the fender off the rear of it, and is beating the car with the fender, and I love this moment because I don't know if it's intentional or not. It could be with Miller being a boomer, but I don't know if you're familiar with the old classic BBC sitcom Fawlty Towers with John Cleese.
John Cleese.
And I don't know if you know the episode map, but where I think it's the Gourmet Night episode where car breaks down. He's bought some food from. Yes, he's transporting some food across town to his restaurant. And his car breaks down, and you've just got John Cleese stepping out of his car and ripping a branch off a tree and shouting at his car, kind of going, right, that's it, right, that's it, I've had it with you, and beating his car up with this. And that's what this whole shot of Dementis beating the car up with the fender reminded me of. Just that he is the battle faulty of the wasteland, you know. He's not a good enough manager to really make a success of this. Oh, yeah.
Let's see. And on the other night, we'll have a big trough of baked beans and garnish it with a couple dead dogs.
Yeah.
They chain up Furiosa, but later Dementis looks up and sees her hand hanging from the chain. So she got out Gerald's Game style. I would like to have seen this fucking thing happen. All we see is the after effect.
I like that we don't see it because it's kind of like this movie, in a lot of ways, gives conventional prequels the middle finger. Where between this and the big emotional revenge payoff that you want, it doesn't entirely give you both. It doesn't have to show it at face value, which I support because these movies have always been about depicting their world to a certain degree in myth or hearsay.
Yeah, but you know what it does give us? Max.
Hey, I fucking hated this, and it's the biggest knock I have on the movie as far as unnecessary stuff. I hated this so much.
I couldn't stand this. I think it takes away from him and Furiosa's first meeting in Fury Road. Like, I hated this. Like, this was Tom Hardy's stunt double from Fury Road, and so they just kind of dressed him up and put him here. Like, I would not think Miller would do this. Mike, it sounds like you're for it.
Well, I don't know if I'm for it, but I don't mind. I kind of... Here's the thing that happens sometimes. Occasionally, people end up being very important in your life. You'll discover that you and they were in exactly the same place at some point before you knew each other.
Yes. C-3PO's R2-D2.
Well, I mean, I don't mind this so much. I just like the idea that, yeah, you know, when Max is going through the wasteland, that little dot in the background could be a human with their own epic story having the worst day of their life. And this character who's completely divorced from humanity and wants nothing to do with them is ignoring it. So I don't mind it so much. It could certainly lose it, and I don't think the film would be any truer for it, but I don't mind it so much. No, I kind of... Yeah.
Wow. We cut to Furiosa driving along the countryside, and we're seeing her have some kind of flash of a witch and maggots. This was weird.
Yeah, she's in the hole in the ground outside the Citadel, where there seem to be people living in holes in the ground. And, okay, this part of the film really gets to me in a strange... Okay, I think earlier in this year, maybe just over the Christmas break, I watched, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's that TBS documentary about the Irish famine of the 1840s, which is great. It's a fantastic documentary. I think it's called The Great Hunger. And like, it's a historical period. I already know a fair bit about simply from being Irish and knowing about my history. But one of the things in that is a lot of people getting evicted and literally having to live in holes in the ground. You know, this is a thing that props up in accounts of sort of Ireland during the famine. And the people literally no longer having a home and just having to dig a hole in the ground and go live in that. And there's something kind of just, you know, humans are resourceful, trying to do what they can to survive. So there's something about that, and the idea kind of says here that this woman who's living in the hole is farming maggots from bits of corpses. It's just such a nightmarish concept, and that's where Furiosa has ended up. Yeah. I really like this, but it is just full, just pure nightmare fuel for me.
Yeah, this was pretty gross, but I liked it. I like when Miller includes imagery like this. It just kind of throws you off, because this is a movie depicting the apocalypse and destitute and dystopian futures and everything else. And when you include stuff like this, it makes me kind of perk up, because I think I said this a couple of weeks ago, I think he would have been a great horror director. So Furiosa meets up with Joe and then tells him of Dementis's plan, and then she says that if you find Dementis, he's hers.
I also love this whole sequence, because we get to see Scrutus really being the complete failsun idiot that he is.
Yes.
That Fuser comes in minus an arm and very articulately explains what Dementis' plan is, and that he's only making them think that Gastown is on fire, and Scrutus still doesn't believe her. And it's Tim Morton Joe's contained fury. You know, or he's not going to lose it with his son, but yeah, you can just see he's terribly disappointed. You know, he's very disappointed with all of the children, and you can kind of see this is why he has this is why he's captured multiple women and is trying to sire a non-embarrassing heir. But, I love this whole sequence just because Scrutus is just such an idiot. I love Scrutus a lot.
I can tell.
Yeah. Also, he's wearing a kilt.
He's wearing a kilt.
I love the fact that he's dressed like a... I don't want to say he reminds me of this person I used to know when I studied in Scotland, but oh God, he does. I knew someone who used to dress like that, and I love that Scrutus kind of, though he's not Scottish, has a lot of a mad Glaswegian I once knew energy about him.
Mick, I've known you for 10 years. I've never heard you perk up like this about a character.
Yeah, he's just such a fun side character. Like the funny characters in these films are so much fun, and Scrutus is just like, oh yeah.
We're seeing the battle on the wasteland in montage form as we have voiceover, and yes, Furiosa is cutting her hair and putting on a robot arm, turning her into the look we know and love.
Okay, so there's this trope that you'll be familiar from science fiction, especially Star Trek. I don't know if it originated this, where, you know how it goes in Star Trek, where they'll talk about, say, music, yes, and maybe Picard or Kirk will say something like, he's one of the great musicians, like Mozart, Duke Ellington, or Gorgolax of Proxima 5. You know, they'll put in two things we know of from our history, then throw in a made-up future thing we don't know of. Yep. And that's kind of, it's this technique they often use in science fiction for sort of a, for world building, yes? And the normal rule is, two things we've heard of, one thing we haven't. And I like the way with this, with the History Man's narration, over Furiosa building her arm and over the wasteland war breaking out. You know, we've got this narration where he talks about how there've always been wars, how Sumerian fought the Elamite, the Saxon fought the Viking. You know, he does this big spiel and he talks about, he references many wars, some well remembered, some obscure, but it keeps going. But then he doesn't just mention one future war, he mentions a couple of things that are terrifying, and he goes, and then the oil wars, the water wars, the tri-nation nuclear wars, and you think, oh, well, that's where it's going to stop. And then he throws one more in where he goes, like, the Battle of the Boomtowns, and I hope they never explain what any of these things are. But I like the fact that George Miller just went, like, yeah, I'm going to ignore that rule. I'm going to add many more things you've never heard of because they only exist in this universe.
Well, we've established, with the exception of this whole movie, which is a continuation of a prequel to last week's film. I mean, this movie's going to cut off literally where we go in Fury Road. We have said in the other podcast, guys, like, Miller doesn't give a shit about continuity. He never has, which makes the fact that he's making this prequel a little odd to me. Matt, did that kind of throw you off, the continuity?
No, because I also like that the war is told entirely through montage.
We see another great desert car chase as Furiosa pursues Dementis.
Okay, this whole sequence where she is getting a vehicle and pursuing Dementis sort of references, but also at points inverts kind of the last act of the first film and kind of subverts our expectations of what we want from a revenge thing, like the fact that she doesn't leave the wasteland and the Citadel in a badass vehicle, because she leaves it in this weird janky thing and then steals a better vehicle.
This whole final third is a complete mindfuck of people coming in expecting a huge spectacle of an ending. This ending really isn't.
No.
You know, and I respect that about Miller. I respect that he did that.
Yeah, this is for the people who love Kill Bill Volume 2.
Yeah. Great, great point. Great comparison. He's then driving away and is pursued, and Furiosa sees one guy completely dismembered.
Yeah.
We cut to Dementis laying face down, but able to get a sip of water as he gets up and says, "You found me." Now, this is certainly a different ending than what we are accustomed to seeing in these films, and it's also when I feel Hemsworth is as worse. I feel these last few scenes of him are comical in how they're acted.
Oh, I think that's the point.
Yeah, I read it as intentional because she is finally seeing him for what he actually is.
Okay. I don't like that direction of this character. I just think it's ridiculous. Dementis kneels down with his hands up as he gets on the ground and she approaches. She walks up and asks if he remembers her as she takes off her veil. He reaches for her sheath knife, but it turns out to be a handle. He says today is the day he dies as Furiosa reminds him of her mom. And then we're given different scenarios of how he died.
Yeah.
One says that...
The clue. Here's how it could have happened.
I know. One says that she shot him. One says that she dragged him behind a car. And then one says that he's been impaled in godly ways. But the one that is believed to be true is this peach seed that she's had this entire film. Well, it's ingested and he has grown a peach tree.
Well, yeah. They say the History Man talks about, like, she has made his part of his flesh necrotic. So, like, maggots are involved. So it's why we've got a couple of references in the film to maggots. There's an earlier reference to sort of people eating maggot mash, you know, in the Citadel. That's one of the foodstuffs mm-hmm. that's referenced when they're talking about inventory. So, yeah, the idea that maggot husbandry is a is very alive and well as a discipline in the wasteland. So she's able to kind of do the thing necessary to turn this guy into living mulch. Is, you know, has been set up a little bit, but I imagine it confuses audiences because this is not what they're expecting.
It completely confuses audiences, and I respect Miller for doing that. I really do. I like the fact that he's gone a different route with this, and I like the fact that he's giving these different scenarios, and that's what myth is all about, right? Myth is about, did it or did it not happen? And you believe it or you don't believe it. The History Man is telling us this is what is the truth because she whispered it in my ear, this is what happened, but it could not be.
No, and this is kind of what, this is also a thing in storytelling and myth, where the storyteller will tell you that he has the privileged information, and he knows what really happened, and I like this, I like that the ending of this, that it has such a rich symbolic value, and it ties back to what Dementa said. You know, that she could gain revenge, but it won't bring her mom back, and it won't make her whole, and you've got to live for something else.
To Mick's point about Terry Gilliam, it turns into Tidelands with the tree.
Oh, God, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
I was like, this is, you're right, he would have been a good horror director, because this is some Cronenberg shit.
It is.
Well, it is, but it's also kind of, you know, the thing it reminded me most of is... There's this, well, rather there was, because she's been dead quite a while now, but there was this English fantasy and sci-fi writer called Tanith Lee. And a lot of her stuff is kind of weird interrogations or investigations of the fairy tales and reinvestigating those. And this feels like the kind of ending she might have written. You know, where it is... It's fairy tale, but it's also just so dark and unsettling. Maybe also a bit...
Yeah, this imagery of him is pretty freaky.
Yeah, I can imagine Angela Carter doing this in a short story and, you know, the literati being impressed by the audacity of it. But I think the audience who turned up for this movie were expecting Dementis to get blown up real good.
Exactly, yeah.
Or drawn and quartered with cars.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. It's kind of weird as well, because his whole ending, his whole third, she picks off all of his men as well, right? In short order, in that pursuit, and it is sort of like the end of the first film, but also completely not. You know, because I guess Max's revenge at the end of the first film leaves him completely dehumanized, whereas with this, it's, you know, it's Furiosa's revenge is the origin story of how she becomes this emancipatory figure who's going to free everyone.
This is the ultimate revenge, right?
Right, yeah. Changing the entire system.
We see Furiosa slam the door as she climbs inside the rig. As credits roll on Furiosa, and why are we having Fury Road scenes during these credits?
Yeah, I
was not a fan of this.
No, I was not a fan of this either. I found it easier to take on the second viewing. I kind of thought, oh, okay, fair enough. It's just, you know, to... I guess establish the idea that there's another film after this and that there's a definite conclusion to this, but I thought it was unnecessary. It's a, I think it's the film's, I want to say, only big editorial misstep.
Mick, aren't you, I'm trying to think back. Me and Matt recorded with like two or three other people.
I know what you're going
to say. But aren't you,
it's the, it's the rule. Don't reference a better movie.
Yeah, exactly. You're the one who told us that, right?
Right, and you know what? I think it's sort of fine here because when I watch this film, what it reminds me most of is there's two French films. I don't know if you know them, but they're films kind of, and they're presented as two chapters of the same story. But Jean de Florette, A Man and the Source. I don't know if you know these movies. And one is one's quite a dark tragedy, and it's a you know, a French farmer, he leads this terrible life and he's horribly wronged. And he's played by Gerard Depardieu because I think that was a law in France at the time. He has to be in all of your movies. And it's a great film, but it's really dark and kind of a downer. But the film that's made back-to-back with it, the sequel, Man and the Source, is about his little daughter from the first film growing up. and she's played by Emmanuelle Béart. And it's her getting revenge on all the people who wronged her dad. And it's the most joyous film. And I, for some reason, I think because I saw them on TV, saw the second of those films first, without having seen Jean de Florette. And I think this film now makes me think about Fury Road that way, right? If I'd seen me seeing Fury Road now, it feels like me having seen Man in the Source, but not having seen Jean de Florette beforehand. And obviously, if you watch both of them, it's a richer experience. And I think I can think of maybe only one other prequel that makes the original film a richer experience. This, and I don't know if you know the Hong Kong film Infernal Affairs.
Yes.
Which Scorsese remade as The Departed, which is not as good. But there's there's a prequel to Infernal Affairs. There's Infernal Affairs 2 is a prequel to the original movie. And it absolutely changes how you contextualize everything in that first film. And I love that this does this too.
For more about Infernal Affairs, check out Prickly Mia's review of The Departed.
Yes, that was our first few months in existence. We reviewed that. All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Furiosa, a Mad Max saga? Mick?
God, this is hard. I'm going to have to go with a 9. There's so much stuff in this that's nine. Wonderful. Yeah, I think if I have one big criticism of this, I said it is perhaps, if you're just watching this in isolation, that ending might not be satisfying in itself if you're not aware of what's to follow. I love this film. I've seen it twice. I can't wait until it comes out on shiny disc so I can own it properly and watch it again. This film, especially the second time around, this film spoke to me on weird levels I can't fully articulate. Which I guess is what this franchise has done with me a couple of times, where there's something deeply mythic and strange. I think the idea is, you know, they say that a myth is something that's made up that feels true. And I think this film kind of feels weirdly true in strange ways. Even though none of this happened, there is no wasteland, none of these characters exist, but there's something about this that just deeply resonates with me as a story. I think it's maybe because of the device of the history man himself and making us think about what myth is.
9 out of 10
yeah.
For Mr. Duffy. Matt, what do you give this culmination of the Mad Max retrospective?
Well, I've been kind of quiet in large part because I saw this movie almost 2 months ago. And when the biggest detracting point I can make against it is, well, it's no Fury Road. That sounds like a much bigger backhanded compliment than it actually is, because I think that's still the biggest thing this movie had to overcome beyond just being a prequel, is you're following up a movie that so many people consider to be the greatest action movie, not just of the millennium, but maybe of all time. It's a damn near impossible task to overcome, and I don't think it quite does that, but for what it is, it's still a damn good time. My issues with it stem from just, I haven't spent as much time with this as I've spent with the other films, especially with World Warrior. Like, I've seen that movie like 50 times. Where this, I've only seen it the one time, and I'm waiting for it to release on physical media so I can watch it again, because I'm not the biggest proprietor of digital movies. For personal reasons, I like tangible stuff when it comes to media, but it was better than I thought it was going to be. But again, it's no Fury Road. I know that's hard, but part of it's also circumstance. But I give George Miller the utmost credit in the world. This has been his baby for 45 years, and he's still got more energy than almost every director working nowadays for a guy who's 80. So in the grand scheme of things, I know where it ranks in the series for me, but should be doing better than it is. But I think it's, to Mick's point, going to find its audience eventually. I'm going to give it a 8 on 10.
8 on 10 from Goudreau. And, you know, for somebody who came into this series not really as big on the other films in it as you boys were, I was very impressed by this film. And I think what I was impressed by is the fact that Miller took a different approach with this. If you can't be as good, if you can't be better than the other product, be different. He knew he wasn't going to reach the plateau of Fury Road. He had something to live up to. Sylvester Stallone had no idea Rocky was going to be as big as it was. And I think Miller did take the different approach in that he's trying to tell a story. What have I been screaming about for four straight podcasts? The action's awesome. It's great to look at. I admire so much of its audacity. But goddamn, I just don't give a shit about Max or anybody. He makes us care here. And I think the performance of Anya Taylor-Joy, while I am a huge proponent of her and I have been on this site forever, I think she's pretty good. I don't think Hemsworth is nearly as good as my two co-hosts do. I think he's chewing the scenery just to chew it. I just don't get a read on that particular character. But the huge chase in the middle of this film is glorious. It could have been trimmed by a few minutes, but you know what? I didn't really think about the time, and my whole tentpole was my fiance. She was sitting right next to me. She had never seen a Mad Max film, as I mentioned before. This was over. She wanted to watch Fury Road right when we got home. She was taken in by this film, as was I. I love the story. I love the revenge aspect of Furiosa. I love seeing how she was emotionally made for the film we reviewed last week. And yeah, it's no Fury Road, but I think it's just as good. I'm giving it the exact same score I give Fury Road. I'm giving it an 8.5. And I think I might give it a slight edge over Fury Road just because of the storytelling aspect of it and the weird places it goes. Whereas Fury Road was mostly a straightforward action film, this one takes different peaks and valleys. And while there are some things like the CGI and things I did not agree with, I liked the storytelling here. So I'm giving this an 8.5 out of 10. Boys, it's time to rank the Mad Max films. We have five films to rank. I'll go first since I kind of sprung this on you guys and I have my list already. I put Furiosa just because, as I just summarized, I think the movie is tremendous in its storytelling. Number two, of course, has to be Fury Road. That is just a journey that we talked about for 2 hours last week, but it just keeps going and going, and it's a world that, yeah, it does have a reputation as a great, great action film, as it should. I don't think it's the best action film ever made, but damn, I can't turn it off every time it's on. Number three, I have Beyond Thunderdome as number three. I think Beyond the Thunderdome, it was much better than I was expecting, honestly. It has some gumption, it has some mid-80s cheese, and it has aspects of Peter Pan that is not subtle. But I enjoy seeing Max have something to actually fight for, even if he didn't give a shit about the kids. Number four, I have Road Warrior. I am in awe of that film when I watch it, but it's not because of anything that's done except for the action. Again, I think Max is just, he's an afterthought, which I get, he's supposed to be. But as I've mentioned, that is not the storytelling I really like. But yet, that has a ton of great action, and I would definitely recommend it. And the only one I probably wouldn't recommend to a newbie to this series is the first Mad Max. I loved the gumption of it. I love guerrilla filmmaking. I love every single part of how the movie got made, but I'm not a huge fan of that film. And I think it stumbles along the way. So my number five is Mad Max. But still, this was a fun series to go through. I had a great time. Mick, do you have your list ready?
I mean, I was thinking about this. And look, first of all, I wouldn't be surprised if you asked me 5 years from now, I might put Furiosa at the top. I need to see this another time, at least. But I would say just currently, with my current thinking, I would have Fury Road at number one, Furiosa at two, Road Warrior at three, Thunderdome at four, and the original film at five.
All right. Matt, what about you, sir?
All right, let the differing opinions continue, because I have Road Warrior at number one, Fury Road number two, Thunderdome three, Furiosa four, Mad Max five.
Wow, so you have Furiosa right near the bottom.
Well, I've only seen it one time. I mean, look, the lowest score I gave in this race has as a 7. Let's not act like I don't like this series.
Oh no, I never said you did. I just find it interesting that me and Mick have it as high as we do. And Mick, you're more surprising to me because as a fan of this series, I thought you would go for the more gusto of the other movies. I didn't think you would go for the storytelling that this film.
No, I love this. I mean, okay. I am very interested in kind of myth and folklore, you know, and that kind of storytelling. Like, I'm a huge fan, I don't know if you remember this, but Jim Henson had a TV show called The Storyteller.
Oh, yes.
I knew in the U.S. it aired as part of the Jim Henson hour on NBC, I believe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so here on this side of the Atlantic, it aired as a separate standalone program. And, you know, I always loved that. That's one of my favorite things. And, you know, I've got a lot of books of folklore, and I like that this film really leans into that, that it leans into sort of playing like a Bronze Age myth. And you know, it's got the word saga in the title, but it earns it. You know, it's structured like a Greek myth. It has five chunks. You know, I love that. And you know what? One thing I think as well here is the fact that this one is going more mythopoetic than the others is probably why I'm more willing to give its CGI a more of a pass, because this film also feels both more emotionally resonant maybe than the other ones, but also more unreal. So I'm going to say one thing I had a note and I forgot, and a note that we need to direct at everyone who complains about the CGI in this. There's one bit that's astonishing that no one notices, which is the actor who plays the bullet farmer died. Mm-hmm. The original bullet farmer has been dead quite a while. So that's a CGI recreation of him, voiced by someone else. So all the shots in this where we see the bullet farmer, and there's only a few, but I think that's a better digitally recreating a dead actor than, you know, the Peter Cushing stuff in Rogue One.
All right. That's a wonderful transition, Mick, because me and Matt want to reveal what we're going to be covering next. And Matt, oh boy, you talk about fights. Why don't you talk about what we're doing next?
So before we venture into our next brand new retrospective that we've never covered before, we have some unfinished business to take care of. And that means involving the return to a galaxy far, far away for the final time, at least for a considerable portion of reality. So we're doing Star Wars, the Disney era, but starting with the 2008 Clone Wars movie that was released in theaters because it did get a theatrical release. Then we'll transition into the acquisition of Disney by, or the acquisition of Star Wars by Disney, the sequel trilogy, the spinoffs, and we'll conclude with our rankings and talking about where we think Star Wars will go from here. But I will preface this by saying, even though these shows have been never discussed among us in our private conversations, I don't know if anyone's going to be left standing by the end of these recordings. We've done some of these already, and we've gone beyond our usual level of arguments to borderline contention, to yelling, to blatant F telling other people to shut the F up. So we've, emotions are going to run high, but I guess that's what happens with Star Wars. But I think everyone's going to be surprised at these shows. I think they're tremendous discussions that are going to spark debate, which is what Star Wars is all about, beyond seemingly arguing about technology and whether or not the prequels are any good. So stay tuned for those.
All right. Thank you, boys. Mick, always fun to have you on, sir. Thank you for taking this road, this Fury Road, shall we say, through the Mad Max series. Yeah. We have plans for you. Don't go very far.
Okay.
We plan on having you back.
Because I was going to quote Dementis.
Oh, quote Dementis.
The thing he says to his gang at the end before they all split up, where he says, "We did mighty things together. Goodbye."
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome!
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please take a look at some of our other retrospectives, where we delve film by film into such other franchises as Star Wars, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Indiana Jones, the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, and so many more. If you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
The men, who are they?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How the hell did you get all this together?
Just happened, Max, you know. Piece from here to piece from there.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
I can do this. I know this machine.
He does. He's a rat hat.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett. And a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What do you suppose he's gonna do?
Retaliate first.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
The last we ever saw of him. He lives now only in my memories.
I mean, I'm trying to think, Garrett, it's been a while since I've seen Avatar 2. What, do we see flashbacks of a young Sigourney Weaver where she's de-aged?
Well, she's only de-aged to, like, how she looked in 2009, so it's not a huge leap.
Yeah.
I suppose the one exception here would be Michelle Yeoh, who does seem genuinely impervious to the aging process and, always moved like somebody who's superhuman and still does.
A lot of the women, just to think about this trend, it's just softening out the wrinkles. and yes. then really doing a lot physically. Like, they did Michelle Pfeiffer in one of the Ant-Man movies to make her look like she did. And the most recent one I could think of was, just because I saw the trailer, speaking of Robert Zemeckis and his witchcraft effects, Robin Wright, the de-aged her. I think that looks horrible.
It looks ghastly. It looks just so ghastly. It just looks so bad, and I wish they hadn't.
Which one was this?
And then for Zemeckis' new movie here, where it's...
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a video game cutscene.
Yeah, I know that, yeah.
No, it looks like, I only ever see these on YouTube because I'm not American, but you know every year at the Super Bowl, they'll have at least one advert which is, older actor reprising their famous role from popular film in the 80s or 90s in this new advert for, you know, Best Buy or Walmart or whatever. And, you know, they just look off or tired. You know, it's, we've got Dana Carvey and Mike Myers back, and we found their old wigs. You know, it's those ads. You know, you get that, and it just feels, oh, did we have to do this? So I'm happy enough to recast.
While I said her larger roles leave a lot to be desired, sorry.
It's okay. Start that again.
Hang on, I gotta put this to voicemail.
Yeah.
While I've made light that, you know, her bigger films haven't.
So let's talk about our screenings of this, if we can think back that far, since it's been about a couple months since the movie's, a month and a half or so since the movie's come out.
Give me 5 minutes, I gotta use the bathroom.
Okay, go ahead.
I will use the bathroom.
Well, usually we wait longer than 25 minutes before we get up and use the restroom.
Yeah, I'm gonna use the restroom as well, just right now. Just
Lord, guys, man, just, you guys have just small bladders.
There's a break, right. So I might as well go for it. Hang on.
All right, go ahead. I'll wait.
He's also 10 years older, so maybe that is a factor. Mm-hmm. Why he does. It does bother. God, this phone rings one more fucking time, I swear to God. it's more noticeable, certainly.
I think there's a little nod to Kurosawa's Yojimbo.
I have not seen that one.
Oh, okay. When the samurai at the start of it wanders into the town, and one of the first things you see is a dog with, I think, if I'm remembering this right, a human hand in its jaws.
I was thinking of Rising Sun.
Oh my God.
That's the first time I've thought of that movie since it was out in 93.
Oh God, yeah. Don't think of that movie ever again.
No, it's a terrible film. Bullets rain down on him as Bullet Town is blown to shreds. Pronouns, pal. What do I mean by him? Dementis, probably. Bullets rain down on Dementis as Bullet Town is blown to shreds. All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Furiosa? What do we give Furiosa? A Mad Max saga.
Okay,
we plan on having you back.
Because I was going to quote Dementis.
Oh, quote Dementis.
The thing he says to his gang at the end before they all split up, where he says, "We did mighty things together. Goodbye." I love that that's big, yeah. So, yeah, that's my style.
You know what? I usually do quotes to conclude this, but you said the perfect quote, so I want to end it with that.
Yeah.